Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Nice high-low here. That's what they got to use, the big guys, when they're in the game.
And Collins is fouled.
And the assist, Karnowski from the top. Look at this. I love it.
Tilly on
what
the floor. Karnowski at last. And that was hard effort by Tilly that made it happen. And a foul to Hicks. And one. Williams.
Short.
Thanks,
oh.
Excuse me.
How about that?
Hicks wanted to drive on Williams. Puts it up.
Oh, wow. That's what you need from that guy. Big time. Palm. Hold. Deliver.
Comes in. Blocked by Meeks. Barry up ahead to Jackson. And he dunks it down for the five-point lead. Off the mark. And this year, the confetti is going to fall for North Carolina. They're not going to be denied this time.
Well, the kids that we've worked with for the last couple of years have been sensational. We came so close last year, and it made them work extremely hard in the offseason to be the best player they could be and to get back to this. And it's amazing that we got back, because it's hard to get here. And then to finish the game out like that, it's pretty special.
I don't think Roy Williams should ever be put in the same sentence with Dean Smith. I really don't. I think Coach was the best there's ever been on the court, and he was an even better person. When I look up at just one of the boards tonight and it saw those guys, they had more titles than our North Carolina teams had, it not Roy Williams, because I don't like it that way. That was a little emotional for a second.
It's a crushing blow right now, but I'm fairly certain perspective will be gained here and, a day or a couple days or weeks or months of just what an amazing year we had, amazing run we had. I think what this group accomplished, we were dealing with kind of a stale attitude towards the Zags in the basketball community from the Porters and people, media, ignited that back to where they look at us as national champion caliber and as they should, and these guys deserve all the credit.
And a high drive, deep right center field. Gomez looking up. Gone to Souvenir City, and Jose Ramirez gets the Indians on the board and right back in the ballgame as it's now 5-3. And he just launched one deep to left, and we are tied at five.
Boy, he speeds up his bat. He went with the breaking ball, and Encarnacion was just waiting for it.
He continues to feast on opposing bullpen. Line drive center field, base hit. Make one around third with the go-ahead run. He will score. 6-5 Cleveland as Abraham Almonte delivers. Swing and a miss. He struck him out to end the game. The Indians with a come-from-behind win on opening night.
We had some real good at-bats because, we got to a point in the game where when guys got hits that were meaningful as opposed to just, feel-good hits. Because that's a hard game to win.
Well, Cleveland obviously is the class of the of Major League Baseball right now, if not the American League. They're an excellent team, but the American League Central Division is still very tough. It's one of the toughest, if not the toughest, division in my mind. So it's not going to be easy. And if anybody thinks that it's going to be easy, they're not thinking right. But we do feel we have a good team, a team that's going to compete.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Starting at the end and working backwards, I have to say there about Alavila, no, you're not going to compete. You're not, because the weather won't let you, for crying out loud. You can't compete if you can't play. And welcome to the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Yeah, it's a fun opening day. And is there anything worse? And, of course, the answer is yes. And we sat here and listed all the things about sports that we hate worse. But work with me here, will you please? There aren't too many things worse than waiting 6 months for baseball to get back, or 5.5 months, whatever it is. Waiting, 6 months roughly for baseball to get back. Finally, you're targeting opening day. Can't wait for opening day. Can't wait for opening day. And then you get to opening day. It's like, yes, let's get this thing going. Let's get this thing started. White Sox hosting Tigers. Let's go. What's that? Yeah, that's about nine or ten hours straight of rain and wind and crap and everything else, and you can't play your opening. That's an awful feeling, isn't it? It's just deflating as hell. But, you know, to answer my own question, Jim Cushla and Frank Gargano with us, to answer my own question, by the way, about the only thing worse than that is the home opener. If it is your opener for the White Sox yesterday, obviously it's theirs. If the Tigers get rained out or snowed out or whatever it out on the home opener at Comerica, that's about the worst thing there is. And I'll never forget being at the Indians home opener back when Mike Hargrove was still managing the Seattle Mariners and they got snowed out about halfway through the fifth inning or something like that. Grover being the literal human snow delay, trying to delay the game and let the snow pile up to the point where the umpires would call it before it became an official game with 5.5 innings. I'll never forget that. And it's just such an, oh my God, we've been waiting for the home opener for so long. And then it gets weathered out, whether it be a snow or a rain or whatever out. That's just about some of the worst experiences in sports, is it not, Chris?
Oh yeah. That's one of the worst, especially for, you know, a lot of teams in Major League Baseball. And no, not just the Indians and their attendance, for those of you out there about to think that. You get the massive sellout for opening day, and then there's 1/8 of the attendance. For example, they're actually playing what was supposed to be yesterday's opener, because they did one of those, you know, opener off day in case of weather, which happened. So they're playing in front of, I don't know, looks like a couple hundred people at guaranteed rate field at the moment. Tigers are, though, winning this one 5-1 in their opening day. To your home opener point, yeah, I hope it's not nasty up around here on Friday afternoon when they come to Comerica host the Red Sox for an afternoon opener, because they don't get the off day after that. That'll just be a postponed makeup later. We'll see you tomorrow.
Right. That's it. And by the way, you mentioned guaranteed rate field. Did you ever look up yesterday so that we could kind of go through the list of the worst?
Yes, I did, Bob. I got a few.
We
got
to get into that, and I don't know if we can do it now. Maybe we'll do that in a little while, but we really have to find out if that is the worst named stadium / arena / ballpark in professional sports today.
I will say on my list, I am not including college. I just went for the four pro majors.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm not including college. There are some weird names if you get that far down.
Most of the college stadiums don't have corporate names, do they?
No, but
some do. Or am I mistaken? I mean, the Big House is the Big House.
Right.
You know, the horseshoe is the horseshoe. It doesn't have a name on it. It's not the Slim Jim horseshoe, right? To my knowledge, I don't even know if any colleges do that.
Well, some do. I know Louisville's football stadium is named something funky with Yum Yum and KFC. I forget, but it has something to do with that. I have to look up what that one is. But
what about those Southern Dandies down there at VaTech? Do they have any corporate names on their stadium?
It's called Lane Stadium. Has been since I was a student and before I was, and still is.
Yeah. Well, what company is Lane? It's got
to
be
that's an old guy having to do with the university.
Donor, I'm sure. I know. I'm just teasing. All right. So anyway, on the extravaganza this afternoon, we will talk about that stadium thing a little bit. We'll talk a little baseball, obviously. Disappointed yesterday that the Tigers did not get to play their season opener. But obviously, as Jim pointed out, 5-1 an early start. They're in the bottom of the third right now. The Tigers with the lead over the White Sox.
Mashed up Jose Quintana, a couple of big home runs in the second inning.
Yeah, well, don't think that leads to victory, by the way, because can I point out to you that last night, Rougned Odor hit a couple of early home runs for the Texas Rangers, and Gomez hit a moonshot, and was it Gomez?
Yeah.
I think hit a moonshot of 461, and they had an identical 5-1 lead.
That they did.
Over the Indians. How did that one turn out? Well, a couple of home runs later, including one from the new guy, why did they spend, how much did they spend on Edwin Encarnacion? I don't remember the contract terms now. But it was a boatload. It was a very non-Cleveland market-style contract for Edwin Encarnacion, and it paid immediate dividends with that blast you just heard in the top of the – was that the 8th or the 9th?
That was the 8th.
That was the 8th. Then top of the 9th, they came up and punched a few more across to take the lead, obviously, and then to pad it a little bit for Cody Allen. But Edwin Encarnacion brought them all the way back, or, you know, provided the solo shot, the jolt that made it 5-5. And then, of course, the rest was up to the Indians' bullpen. Tremendous work by Andrew Miller in the eighth. Tremendous work by Cody Allen in the ninth. Or was it Cody Allen? I'm trying to remember.
He went Allen in the eighth and Allen in the ninth, Miller in the eighth.
Miller in the eighth, like we expect. Yeah. I don't know about you, but I was flipping back and forth, you know, with the national championship game.
Me too.
And I want to start with that. You know, like I said, we're kind of working our way backwards here. on the montage rundown, and I want to go to the front of it now, which was the NCAA championship game. Cushland, Frank Gargano, do you think that that was an ugly national championship game? Was it as unappealing, unappetizing, lack of flow, et cetera, that so many people are saying all across the country today that it was, and did it affect your enjoyment of the game?
It didn't really affect my enjoyment of the game. You are going to have games like that every now and again, but at the same time, yeah, was it as anywhere near as exciting as, say, last year's or other random years like that? No, absolutely not. It was definitely kind of an ugly game, but sometimes you get those. And so I didn't feel it really ruined it, but did it stack up to some years past? Good Lord, no.
What do you think, Frank?
Yeah, I think you pointed out yesterday, we've been really spoiled with the championship games we've been seeing lately.
Oh, yeah.
From this past year. We've been really spoiled. So I don't think it was that bad. It was a pretty competitive game. It could have been way worse. Did it hold my highest interest? No, probably not, but I didn't think it was ugly.
To your point about that, I agree. It didn't hold my interest. There was a reason I kept flipping back and forth between baseball and the game. Technically, even though it's the season opener, it shouldn't have that much appeal if a national championship game that is really worth watching is on the other channel. I just, you know, keep maybe checking Twitter or checking my phone. Checking the ticket app and seeing what scores are, and I could see where the baseball game is, but I don't really need to watch it all. And I watched more of it than I should have, or that, you know, I should have wanted to because of the style of game that was being played. So just to be clear about that, that's why I couldn't remember if it was Miller and Allen. And, well, I knew it was Miller in the eighth, and I was trying to confirm that it was Cody at the end, because I did not watch the end of the game. So, because I was watching basketball. So to my point here is, I have read a number of articles today, some of them from prominent national writers on ESPN.com, CBS.com, Fox Sports, blah, blah, blah. Some of them just from bloggers and some social media comments as well. And I've heard a lot of people blabbing about what an ugly game that was and how that was not much fun to watch. The referees blew their whistles too many times. I listened to Mike and Mike this morning, as I often, if not always, do, and I certainly hope you do as well, and they were doing the same thing. Greenberg and Golic and Dan Dokich all this morning complaining about too many whistles. Let the players get into a flow of the game. Why are we stopping at every 6 seconds with a foul call? Let them get into a rhythm and a flow to let the players decide. Did you see who was complaining on Twitter last night during that?
No, I didn't.
Two pretty prominent NBA stars, LeBron James and Dwayne Wade. LeBron James tweeted something to the effect of, I'm done watching. Can't even watch it anymore. Let the players decide the game, bruh, he said. Hashtag SMH, you know, shaking my head.
Mm-hmm.
Dwayne Wade said something similar, too. Too many fouls, too many fouls, too many fouls. So that seemed to be a pretty prominent point of view, but I read some other things today. Like I said, I really try to, you know, get as many different viewpoints on topics of the day that we might talk about here on the Extravaganza as possible every day. And I read some others that really, really kind of were much more in line with my way of thinking. And the alternative point of view for this was, what last night's NCAA championship game had that made so many people uncomfortable was old school basketball played by large men who didn't fall in love and who don't, generally speaking, fall in love with the new school 3-point shooting is the way to play the game philosophy. You saw a couple of really tall teams. Gonzaga had 2 or 3 7-foot guys. UNC had a bunch of bigs, a very strong front court, up in the, you know, 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", range, all across the front court. And they didn't have a bunch of 6'7", 8'9", guys who were great 3-point shooters. And Gonzaga didn't have a bunch of great 3-point shooters either. And we have come to watch the NBA, and then it trickles down to the college game in large part. We've come to watch it as a track meet, where there is very little defense being played and a lot of long bombs being shot. And because a lot of long bombs are being shot, you got defenses out there on the perimeter trying to contest those shots. And then you've got, you know, slashes to the basket, cutters to the basket going in untouched for dunks or layups. And you don't have an opportunity for a whole lot of fouls. But last night, you didn't really get all of that. Last night in the national championship game, it wasn't ugly as far as I'm concerned. It wasn't ugly because the referee slowed the game down too much with foul calls. It was ugly, if you want to use that term, because the two teams played ugly. They played inside basketball, the kind that 15 years ago we wouldn't have thought twice about. We would have said, great game. A lot of guys being aggressive, a lot of banging on the boards, a lot of challenges on defense in the middle. But today, 15 years later, and I'm kind of guesstimating around that time frame, but roughly 15 years later today, you know, we're not used to seeing so much traffic inside. We're not used to seeing so many post-ups. We're not used to seeing so many bigs playing near the basket for high percentage shots and thus having to be defended near the basket on those high percentage shots, thus leading to a lot of fouls. We're used to seeing the ball working around the perimeter, you know, swing it to the corner, swing it back, skip pass, inside, kick out, three. And that really fast-paced kind of, you know, distance, long-distance type of shooting, if you will, that, you know, that we've become accustomed to, that sort of thing makes a game like yesterday, which in and of itself, I don't believe was quote-unquote ugly, look ugly by comparison, when what it really was is just old school. There used to be a time when the game was played that way. I read three different articles today about this. And I read many more people saying the referee. I mean, right here, let me just grab one from ESPN.com just to share the headline. The headline was, that was not a good national title game. And then the subheading, referees, missed shots, poor play, make for forgettable national title game. And I'm thinking, wait, you know, it wasn't forgettable. It was just old school. You know, they're calling it poor offense. Why? Because we didn't have 49 threes being taken? They're calling it, over-officiated. Why? Because there was a lot of contact, and the referees, normally we don't see a lot of contact in today's modern no-defense NBA, and the referees called them all. That's what I'm seeing here. I'm going to get some other opinions on this. I want to find out. Golic and Greeny and Dokic couldn't complain enough today about it. And I'm going to disagree with them. It wasn't aesthetically pleasing, maybe per se, but it's only because of what our aesthetics have, you know, have become. What we have come to know as aesthetically pleasing. What we have come to know, I should say, in the last decade and a half. All right, got to get a timeout here. Before I do that, though, you know that they will be playing golf at Augusta in 2 days. Get your fantasy golf lineup put together at FanDuel.com in time for the first round of play on Thursday morning. That's right, FanDuel now has fantasy golf. If you love golf and winning cash, then you want to try fantasy golf on FanDuel. It's so cool and it's easy. Pick 8 golfers for your team. Score points for eagles, birdies, pars, and more. There's something for everybody. Contest starting at just $1 at FanDuel.com. You'll watch your score live as the rounds go on and win cash prizes. And don't miss Thursday's $750,000 Golden Eagle Golf Tournament with $100,000 to first place. That's right, and that contest only costs $4 to enter. But you got to get your lineup submitted before tee-off on Thursday morning. And, of course, now that baseball is here, daily fantasy baseball is back on FanDuel as well. Over 2.5 million players have won cash prizes at FanDuel. Here's what you do to experience the fun. To get you started, we are going to hook you up. That's right. New users get a combo 5-pack valued at up to $50 for free. That's 5 free entries to a combination of 50-50 beginner contests. Just finish in the top half to win cash. To get your 5 free entries at FanDuel.com, go to the website, click the Join Now button, and enter the promo code France. That's my last name. Spell it right in order to get the deal. FRANTZ. That's FanDuel.com, promo code France, void where prohibited. We are going to talk a little baseball on the other side of the Sports Center that is coming up. The changing role of the relief pitcher, as identified by and personified by Andrew Miller. We're going to talk to Sam Hill of ESPN.com, coming right up here on ESPN.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on, are we? It is 3:33. Thanks for joining us on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Tremendous season opener last night for the Indians. A great start to the season for the Tigers, by the way, as well. Jim just updated you on the score from Chicago. But the Indians were down deep in the heart of Texas last night. A comeback win. They were down 5-1. They inched back. They got some power. They got some timely hits. And they got some of the best relief pitching in baseball thanks to American League Championship Series hero and MVP Andrew Miller, who is essentially redefining, or at least he personifies the redefinition of relief pitching and closing in Major League Baseball today. Sam Miller with ESPN.com wrote a tremendous piece about this for ESPN the magazine. It's also on the website right now at ESPN.com. Forget the ninth inning. Andrew Miller is here to save the game. He joins us now to discuss right here on The Ticket. Sam, thanks for your time this afternoon. How you doing?
Good. You're welcome.
Appreciate spending a little bit of time with us to talk about this. You know, it was so interesting last year. I happen to be an Indians fan. You know, we're here in Toledo, and we got probably a good majority of Tigers fans, but a good number of Indians fans here, too, as we kind of are right between those two big markets. And I'm an Indians fan, so I watched this thing last year, and I was trying to figure out what is Terry Francona doing using Andrew Miller early in long relief, not really long relief, but earlier in a game where a long reliever would come in at some points, if that's what it took to get out of a situation, sometimes in the eighth, sometimes to close. Obviously, every button he pushed pretty much right up through the World Series was just about right. But there is a new approach now, or maybe is only a guy like Andrew Miller able to give a manager a new approach on how best to use relievers to save games?
Well, I don't think he's the only one who's able to offer a manager that. I think he's unique for a couple of reasons. One is that he's arguably the best reliever in baseball. So he's well suited to any role that you could put him in.
Would you be one to argue that, by the way, Sam, when you call it him arguably? Because that's a really neat debate and was really going on all last year, especially when he and Chapman were kind of dueling in the series. Would you make that argument that he is the best reliever in baseball?
I probably would. I believe he is, but the thing about relievers is with them only throwing about 60 or 70 innings a year and having, one or two outings really define their season sometimes, there's three or four guys you could put in that conversation, and I certainly wouldn't tell Dellin Betances to his face or maybe Kenley Jansen to his face that they're not as good as anybody out there. It is an interesting discussion that because of the samples of relief usage, you can never really answer. But he's so good at this role for one reason, because of how good he is, but I mean mainly because of how willing he is. There's been a real reluctance, I think, for teams to get too creative with their bullpens, especially with the aces in their bullpens, for a couple of reasons. One is that the pitchers themselves have gotten to be pretty comfortable with the traditional bullpen hierarchy, where you have your best reliever pitching in the ninth inning in a very tightly defined way that is very predictable, and in some ways it's a difficult role, but in some ways it's also an easier role. And so you sometimes do hear veteran closers or even young closers talk about how important it is that they're in that role specifically, and that they're used in a way that they can kind of anticipate how they're going to be used. And that's a very important thing that teams take very seriously. They don't want to have relievers that are uncomfortable. But it really restricts the amount of value that you could possibly get out of your reliever if you know he's only going to be pitching three outs in most games, and if you know he's only going to be pitching in these predefined roles that aren't necessarily the most important role in an individual game.
You know, last year's American League playoffs were just so amazing as far as illustrating this point, because on one hand, you have the way Terry Francona used Andrew Miller, and as you point out, rather than confining him and restraining him in this predefined role in which he may not ever come up, the situation may not ever come up where you need to use him, he used him all over the place compared to what Buck Showalter did with Zach Britton with the Orioles, and he took huge heat for. I'm a huge Buck Showalter fan, by the way, as much as I am Terry Francona. I'm a huge Zach Britton fan, too, but we all know what happened there. The perfect defined role didn't present itself, and so he did not use him until that role, was there for him. And so that's a perfect kind of, summary of there's the old school way, and then there's the new school way, saying, you use him whenever you need him.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's two things that Terry Francona would say that really kind of lend themselves to the way that he's using Andrew Miller. One is, he says simply, we want to use our best relievers as much as we can. And if you know you're only going to get three outs, well, a lot of games, that's all you need from him. But if he gets those three outs in, you know, seven pitches, well, he's got more bullets in that arm. But by now the game's over, and you've kind of, you know, arguably wasted a few of those pitches that he could have thrown. But the other thing he says is that he's a big believer in the idea that the game is sometimes saved in the sixth inning, sometimes it's saved in the seventh inning. Mm-hmm. And he is more comfortable taking his chance of running out of his best pitchers because he didn't quite get to the end, rather than watch those games get blown in the seventh inning. When you've been managing as long as Terry Francona has, you could certainly probably pull up in your memory a lot of games that you lost in the sixth or seventh inning because you were going with a guy who's, you know, got 30 career innings or who's, you know, too wild for the ninth inning. And so if you can put somebody like Miller into that biggest spot in the game, in the sixth, if he sort of consents to that, then it gives you a weapon that is not just, you know, a second weapon, but a whole new weapon.
We are talking to Sam Miller, no relation to Andrew Miller, I am assuming, of ESPN the magazine,
nope.
ESPN the magazine and ESPN.com about relief pitching. You know, real quick, before we get into more depth, and I want to ask you more about those defined roles, Sam, you quote in your article Bill James from the Historical Baseball Abstract about Napoleon, the real inventor of relief pitching. Tell us that story.
So the story that he tells is that Napoleon was a big believer in this idea that all battles tended to find this kind of equilibrium where they would sort of find a close game in any battle. And so what he would do is, you know, if he had, you know, 10,000 troops or something like that, he'd send 8,000 of them out, and then he'd have 2,000 of them resting somewhere waiting to be called in late. And so this battle that would be fighting would find its kind of equilibrium. And then toward the end, he would have these, you know, 2,000 troops charge in fresh, and they would be kind of like the closer. They would be the only fresh people left. And according to this accounting, as Bill James says, if that's not relief pitching, I don't know what is.
It's so well explained. I love it, and I loved it in Bill James, and I love that you recounted it for this article, and it's perfectly accurate. My producer and co-host Jim Cushman's got a question for you, but real quick on the defined roles that you talked about. You know, Goose Gossage has been, you know, he's been the get off my lawn guy lately about the modern game. And there's a lot of those guys. And in some ways, I identify with them. I really do, because I like old school. There's no school like the old school. And I have to admit, you know, I don't know how we got to where we are, where a closer can only work in that ninth inning. And very few exceptions will only work the three outs that are the ninth inning, or if they do hold them, you know, to pitch in the 10th inning or 11th inning, whenever a game needs to be saved. But why they don't use the 7th, 8th, you know, the same guy for the 7th, 8th, and 9th anymore? Is it simply a training thing where arms are being trained to go that short serviceable amount rather than working a little bit longer? Because, you know, again, not to give, you know, all credit to Gossage here saying everything was better then than it is now, I do feel like that the workload that those guys took on made them more valuable than the one-inning wonders that we see today.
Yeah, it probably made them more valuable. I think it probably also made them a lot more prone to injury. And I think that if the argument is that pitchers can throw, you know, 145 innings in relief like Gossage might have done in the 70s, that's probably unrealistic. That ship has sailed. And, you know, knowing what we know about pitcher usage, pitcher arm injuries, it's probably just unrealistic. That doesn't mean, though, that you can't use them in a way that is even more highly leveraged and a little bit more flexible. And I think the key to that is really, I think it's twofold, but it really goes, I think, to the definition of what a save is. There was a point in time where the save was not what we know it is now. There was about 15 years, really even 25 years, if you go back to the first person who came up with it, where there was a sort of negotiation about what would qualify as a save. Mm-hmm. So at certain points, all you had to do was finish the game. It didn't matter how large a lead it was. You could save a game by getting one out with a 12-run lead. And then there were other times where it was really very specific and strict. For instance, it had to be a one-run lead, or if it was a two-run lead, you had to throw a perfect inning. But there was a crucial period in the late 60s, early 70s, where you could get a save and you didn't have to finish the game. And so when Raleigh Fingers was coming up, for instance, and he was a fireman for the Athletic, he didn't have to close games to be the closer, or I guess to be the guy who got the saves. And
right.
So there would be games where he would come in, and maybe he'd come in the sixth and he'd get out of the jam, and he might go the seventh, might even go the eighth, and then he'd get relieved by another one of the Athletic's pitchers. And so he wouldn't get that save. Well, he wouldn't get the final out, but he would get the save. And what Raleigh says is, you know, he didn't really mind that he wasn't the last guy on the mound, because he knew that he was the first guy that the manager was going to. He knew, by the way that he was being used, that he was still sort of at the top of that bullpen hierarchy. Well, in 1975, the rules for the save got codified, and ever since then, you've had to get the final out to get the save. And so if you're basically a pitcher who knows that you're going to get paid based on your stats in arbitration or on the free agent market, and you can pitch three innings in relief and get no record whatsoever, like there's just no recognition of what you did, or you could pitch the ninth inning and get the save and get paid in arbitration later, well, you're obviously going to subconsciously or maybe consciously want the role that gives you the glory stat. And so ever since that save rule got codified, you've seen a real emphasis on making sure that your best reliever gets the final out of the game, even though the final out of the game is not always the most important one. And even though, I think crucially, if you make it so that you have to get the final out, then it makes it harder and harder for the manager to bring you in, even in the eighth inning when the game might be on the line, because he knows, well, you could probably get four outs or five outs or six outs, but he doesn't know for sure. And he doesn't want to run out of his closer. He doesn't want to basically get to the point where his closer can't be on the mound for the final out of the game. And so you sort of have to get a little bit more conservative with the way that you use your pitcher. It almost rules out the idea of using them in any way other than the one that you know is going to get him to the finish line.
But is that changing, Sam? Because, I mean, again, let's go back to Miller, to Andrew Miller. You know, I mean, look at the postseason. He was used two innings against Boston, two innings against Boston, two innings against Toronto, 2.2, 2 2/3. I'm looking at it in a stat sheet. 2 2/3, another two against Chicago, twice in the World Series. So, you know, we're saying, you know, we don't want to use our best reliever more than just that one inning, and yet he is clearly the best reliever, and probably, as you pointed, that you could argue is the best reliever in baseball, and they're using him for more than just the one inning, and he doesn't have to get the final out. So is he the aberration, the outlier, or is he the, you know, is this the wave of the future?
Well, and the key thing there is that they're not trying to get him to save. So they can bring him in and then use him until he can't go anymore, right?
Right. I mean, and the reason I ask is because when you frame it with, you know, you want your best reliever to get the final out, which is the traditional quote-unquote closer. But that saves, I guess what I'm asking is, as you pointed out, somebody who wants to get paid is going to want to have that ninth inning role because that's the marquee statistic, the save statistic. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that way because Cody Allen, I don't think anybody would argue, is not better than Andrew Miller. He's going to get that save, that final out. But Andrew Miller's work doing that before him, you know, especially for multiple innings, is equally, if not more, overall valuable.
Yeah, and so the key thing about Andrew Miller's willingness here is that he doesn't seem to care about getting the save as far as the financial benefits for him. One reason for that is because he's signed to a long-term deal as it is. And so in his sort of mental calculus, he knows that it doesn't really matter whether he's getting a save or not. Next year, his salary is going to be the same because he's under this current contract. For another reason, he really does seem to be notably, I guess humble would be one way to describe it, but notably sort of unegotistical, unambitious about that sort of thing. And he isn't the kind of guy who's going to put up a fight. As he puts it, he's never had the agent whispering in his ear, you got to get those saves. And he's never been the client who's telling his agent that he wants to get those saves. But the third thing is, I think that he sort of recognizes, and I think maybe Cleveland recognizes, and probably a lot of people in the game recognize it, there is probably such a sort of a unanimous a belief among baseball front offices that you don't have to be the closer to be a valuable reliever. And everybody's kind of expecting that the market, the gap between closer pay and non-closer pay will start to shrink, particularly as, you know, for instance, if Andrew Miller hits free agency, again and continues to pitch in this role, he'll almost certainly get paid at the same level that Aroldis Chapman and Kenley Jansen got paid, even though he doesn't have the closer role. And so there's a little bit of a leap of faith here that that the market is going to become a little bit more sensible about this stuff and not penalize guys, because the birth of the save was, you know, the birth of the save was really an attempt to give credit to relievers who were having a huge effect on a team's success, and it was a way to make sure that they got recognized, to make sure that they got rewarded and paid. But what it did is that it made it so that everybody else in the bullpen was getting overlooked, that they weren't getting paid. And you can see traditionally a huge discrepancy between what the best closers make and what the best setup men make, even if you look at how good they pitch in every other measure of performance. Even when you have a setup man who's as good as a closer, he just doesn't get paid the same. And I think there's a feeling that that is going to close up. It hasn't closed yet, and there are lots of recent examples of guys in arbitration in particular not getting paid as much as closers just because they weren't pitching in the ninth inning. There's a feeling that that isn't going to be that way forever. And that really is the key, because if the pitchers themselves don't see a financial, a sort of a disproportionate financial benefit to pitching in the ninth, it's probably not going to be as important to them. It's probably not going to be something they fight as much about. Right. And if they can see that pitching in the seventh or the sixth or the eighth, like Andrew Miller has, is really the best way to help their team win, they're going to be a lot more open to it.
Sam Miller is our guest from ESPN, the magazine, and ESPN.com, talking about a tremendous piece he wrote for the magazine coming up on relief pitching and how it is being redefined. Jim Kushlin is with us as well. Jimmy, go ahead. What's your question?
You know, and thinking about it more and hearing you explain it a little bit, Sam, and reading from your article, which, again, part of the title is The Tyranny of the Save, that's kind of in a way what we're dealing with. And we've crossed the threshold some point in the last 20 years or so. We've clearly crossed the threshold where this whole concept and how bullpens are organized is more of for, you know, players negotiating and arbitration, not necessarily how it may be best played, you know, on the field in, say, mid-July. Because you're right, we've all noticed that closers get paid way more than the eighth or the seventh inning guys and all down the line. So part of this tyranny of the save, if you will, is how it's grafted itself onto where relievers pitch, what stats they accumulate, which means, and you kind of point this out, I'd love for you to try to explain it to us, there's got to be a way, because they're creating stats all the time, to kind of equalize it out for your quote-unquote non-closer relievers. And the other thing that I loved about some of your explanations of how maybe to kind of help with that is you get more, somehow have more Andrew Miller type relievers or more managers using them. We discussed all last October that, yeah, that's one thing for the postseason, but it's going to take a while and it would never operate in the same way over 162. So kind of explain to me, is a new stat possibly part of the future game plan here, or is this going to have to come down to managers basically copying Terry Francona in a mid-July kind of mode as opposed to, you know, really throwing the doors open in an October situation?
Yeah, so there's a few questions in there. One, I think it is crucial to separate the postseason from the regular season, because nobody thinks that Andrew Miller can go 2 2/3 every outing and pitch in every Cleveland win in the regular season without burning out. But if you look at the way that Terry Francona used him last summer, it was also still very revolutionary. He was using him to bridge multiple innings. Even if he was only getting 3 or 4 outs at a time, he was coming in to face the other team's best hitter with runners on as early as the sixth inning, which is just not what you would expect. I mean, obviously, Aroldis Chapman is not being used that way. Kenley Jansen's not being used that way. No team uses their quote-unquote closer that way. And so simply by taking a guy like Andrew Miller, who would be, you know, the best closer on any team, and using him in that way is already a big leap. But yeah, I was shocked by how openly everybody would talk about the financial incentives, because this is basically a strategy decision. This is a situation where a manager, you would think, should be deciding, well, what's the best way for me to win this game? And yet they're very open about the fact that the finances factor into this decision. They know that the players get paid based on these saves. The players are not going to be happy if you take away their saves, if you try something new that costs them their saves. You know, everybody talked about this. You know, Andrew Miller talked about it, and Chris Antonetti talked about it, and Francona talked about it, and other relievers talked about it. They're very open about the fact that it is inseparable. The amount of money that is at stake in this decision about who to let get the save is just so large that you can't ignore it, even though it shouldn't really be part of the strategy of the moment. And so in order to get past that, you really do need to have another way of rewarding relievers who aren't getting the save. And to some degree, the ability to do that already exists. I mean, we can generally look at how good pitchers are without looking at their saves total and see who the best relievers are. But there are also there have been attempts to come up with stats that would sort of replace the save or broaden it to the whole league. And one of these stats is called shutdowns, and it was created in the sabermetric community about 6 or 7 years ago, and it basically rewards a pitcher for the size of their impact on the team's win probability, regardless of what inning. And it was created by a guy named Tom Tango, who's a legendary sabermetric writer. And it is a really good stat that I think I like a lot, and is a much better stat than a save for, you know, the reasons that you guys have alluded to. But the problem is that teams aren't particularly interested in replacing the save, because if they start having to pay 7 relievers instead of just 1 reliever for their impact on the game, then it could even get more expensive. So, like, I talked to one GM who I'm pretty sure is familiar with and a fan of the shutdown over the save, and he's like, I'm not going on the record saying that I like that stat. It'll be used against me in an arbitration hearing somewhere down the line. You start worrying about how much it's going to cost you to pay all your setup men as though they're closers. And so they actually have this sort of perverse incentive to prop this up, even if it makes it harder for them to make the right strategic decisions in the eighth and ninth inning sometimes.
That is a fascinating discussion. I mean, really, because, you know, the idea that owners' pockets could impact managerial decisions and roster decisions, et cetera, to this degree. Well, roster, I guess I understand, but particularly managerial decisions as to who we use and when we use them based on what it's going to cost and how much value we place on this, et cetera, because it's going to be part of the next negotiation. It's really just, I got to believe that this is something that drives managers crazy. And I don't care if it's Terry Francona or Brad Ausmus or anybody else for that matter. It's, you know, you want to be able to use the guys how you want to use them because it's the right thing for that situation, not, hey, you know, this guy's getting paid to be in this inning to get that last out. I've got to use him there or he's going to be mad. If I need him to go in the seventh, even though he's got better numbers, let's just say historically, against the three guys that are coming up in the seventh, it would make more sense for me to use him here. I can't because he's paid like the guy who gets the last out. That's got to drive managers nuts.
It probably does to some degree. On the other hand, it makes their decisions a little bit easier if they don't have to think through their bullpen hierarchy all that much. If they can put a guy in the closer role and say, well, it's his responsibility. If the closer blows a game, nobody's second-guessing the manager. And in a sense, that kind of creates a little bit of a security blanket for that manager. I would imagine that it's also frustrating because it makes it harder for them to manage to win. But at least it does sort of prevent them from being second-guessed quite so much. And, you know, Francona mentioned this as well. He said, you know, look, when Cody Allen, you know, if you lose a game in the ninth because Cody Allen blows a save, well, all you've done is lost a game. Nobody's getting too upset about it. But if you start doing kind of weird things or you start getting guys out of their role and now you lose the game in the ninth inning, then it sort of creates a sense of chaos that can very easily spiral out of control. And so There is an aspect of it that I think that they appreciate having that stability, just as the pitcher appreciates having that stability, because it makes their decisions a lot simpler. That said, I think it's probably a lot more frustrating for front offices, though. I think I've always sort of assumed that managers don't mind the closer role being what it is nearly as much as the front offices do.
Yeah, and I can certainly understand that from that vantage point. I just don't like the idea of mixing contract demands and negotiations with baseball decisions on the field.
No, it's crazy. You know, it's amazing. I just couldn't believe it.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe how open they were to it. Yeah, you can't imagine that in any other situation. You can't imagine a manager coming out and saying, "Well, I couldn't call for a sacrifice bunt there because I'm paying the guy too much."
That's a great point. That's exactly what we're talking about. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Last thing, you used the word in your article, fireman. There used to be fireman of the year award. The you know, they used to be called the fireman of the year, you know, the best relief pitcher. And usually it was a closer, or what back then was defined as the closer. But the reason it got the name fireman, and now they don't even have that, do they, Sam? It's reliever of the year, correct?
I think that you're correct. Yeah, I knew this a couple weeks ago, and now it's not quite as fresh. But I believe you're correct. I think the Fireman Award is officially
defunct.
yeah, I do know for a fact, guys, it is not called the Fireman of the Year Award. That was discontinued in part of the name at least 10 years ago. Was the last time I recall.
Yeah, and this is the reason why. And it kind of just it circles back around to what we started our conversation with, or at least part of it. Part of it is. They used to call it a fireman because you had to come in and rescue a situation. You know, the starter left a couple of guys on and can't get that third out. We need somebody to come in and get that third out in the eighth and then maybe work the ninth. You know, going back to the Gossage thing, hell, maybe it's the seventh. But, you know, the fireman is to come in and put out the flames. There's guys on base, and we got to get out of this situation. It's why it was called Fireman of the Year. And now the vast majority of these closers that are negotiating for these contracts you're talking about expect to put out no fires. All they've got to do is come in with the bases empty, don't give up more than three runs, and you get a save, and you get the big contract, and you get the negotiation and all the rest. So, I mean, it kind of brought it back to my memory when you talk about Miller not being afraid to play the role of fireman. What is fireman in today's baseball?
Well, he loved the term, I think. My sense was that he loved the term, and he talked about whether it was coming back and whether there would even be guys who were only coming in 40 games but pitching 80 innings. The key thing, I mean, one of the things that really I kept in mind while I was working on this piece was how much the language that we use affects these decisions. And one of the key words that we use is save, of course, but another word that we use is closer. And I was reading a book by the baseball historian John Thorne in 1978 about the evolution of relief pitchers up to what was then the present. Mm-hmm. And the word closer does not appear in that entire book. It didn't exist as a term. It was around that time that Bruce Sutter had some arm injuries, and so the Cubs started using him in a much sort of more limited role, and he would only close games. And after that, sometime in the 80s, the term appears to have taken off. And choosing that word instead of fireman really does change the expectations of the pitcher, because again, if you have to close, then that means that you are unavailable for certainly seven innings of the game, and probably eight, because the manager doesn't want to run out of time you know, before he's gotten everything out of you. And so the word fireman, I think simply bringing it back and simply turning it back into a kind of a heroic role that we talk about would have an influence. And I was sort of glad I saw Andrew Miller mention that term in another article. And I think just having that language where we're sort of more open to defining success in ways that are broader than just this one narrow closer role, I think will really open it up so that more pitchers are willing to work in this way. And if they are, then more managers are willing to manage in this way. And if they are, then GMs are going to be starting to build their rosters around the idea.
It's a fantastic philosophy and a great look at the entire role of relief pitching being kind of redefined now. Again, you'll find it in ESPN, the magazine. You can also find it right now at ESPN.com. Sam Miller, the writer, terrific stuff and great conversation. Sam, thanks so much for the enjoyable conversation.
Yep, thank you.
Have a great day. Thank you, sir. All right, there's Sam Miller joining us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. If you want to follow up on that, we can. I'd like to talk to you about a number of things in the second hour. We're guest-free in hour number two, so we can talk about that. We can talk about the basketball championship game last night and so much more as well. Tony Romo is a story again. We'll get you updated on Brian Kelly's critical comments about Central Catholic grad DeShone Kizer going into the NFL. A lot more to come. Be a part of it with us at 866.
Nice high-low here. That's what they got to use, the big guys, when they're in the game.
And Collins has fouled.
And the assist, Karnowski from the top. Look at this. I love it.
Tilly on
what
the board.
Pass.
Karnowski at last. And that was hard effort by Tilly that made it happen. And a foul to Hicks. And one. Williams.
Short.
Thanks,
oh.
Excuse me.
How about that?
Hicks. One in the drive on Williams. Puts
How about
it up.
That?
Oh, wow.
That's what you need from that guy. Big time. Palm. Hold. Deliver.
Comes in. Blocked by Meeks. Barry
right
up ahead to Jackson. And he takes it down for the 5-point lead. off the mark, and this year the confetti is going to fall for North Carolina. They're not going to be denied this time.
Well, the kids that we've worked with for the last couple of years have been sensational. We came so close last year, and it made them work extremely hard in the offseason to be the best player they could be and to get back to this. And it's amazing that we got back because it's hard to get here. And then to finish the game out like that, it's pretty special.
I don't think Roy Williams should ever be put in the same sentence with Dean Smith. I really don't. I think Coach was the best there's ever been on the court, and he was an even better person. When I look up at one of the boards tonight and it saw those guys, you know, they had more titles than our North Carolina teams had, it not Roy Williams, because I don't like it that way. That was a little emotional for a second.
It's a crushing blow right now, but I'm fairly certain perspective will be gained here and, you know, a day or a couple days or weeks or months of just what an amazing year we had, amazing run we had. I think what this group accomplished, we were dealing with kind of a stale attitude towards the Zags in the basketball community from the Porters and people, media. They ignited that back to where they look at us as national champion caliber and as they should, and these guys deserve all the credit.
And a high drive, deep right center field. Gomez looking up. Gone to Souvenir City, and Jose Ramirez gets the Indians on the board and right back in the ballgame as it's now 5-3. And he just launched one deep to left, and we are tied at 5.
Boy, he speeds up his bat. He went with the breaking ball, and Encarnacion was just waiting for it.
He continues to feast on opposing bullpen. Line drive, center field, base hit. Make one around third with the go-ahead run. He will score. 6-5 Cleveland as Abraham Almonte delivers. Swing and a miss. He struck him out to end the game. The Indians with a come-from-behind win on opening night.
We had some real good at-bats because, you know, we got to a point in the game where when guys got hits that were meaningful as opposed to just, you know, feel-good hits. Because that's a hard game to win.
Well, Cleveland obviously is the class of Major League Baseball right now, if not the American League. They're an excellent team, but the American League Central Division is still very tough. It's one of the toughest, if not the toughest, division in my mind. So it's not going to be easy. And if anybody thinks that it's going to be easy, they're not thinking right. But we do feel we have a good team, a team that's going to compete.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling into hour number two, we are right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Hey, you know, I've been telling you about the FanDuel Fantasy Golf, and I'm telling you that if you go to the website, which is FanDuel.com, and if you enter my name the little button, the Join Now button. If you enter my name, France, FRANTZ, there, you'll get 5 free entries worth up to $50 in contest entries. I've got something even better for you now. How about this? This is very cool. They just gave this to me. And for one of my lucky listeners, you're going to want a $25 credit to play on FanDuel right now. You don't have to go online. You don't have to do anything. You'd have to go online to claim it. But I'll give you a $25 credit right now to play on FanDuel if you're caller number 8. Let's make Mr. Gargano answer a couple of phone calls here. Caller number 8 to 866-240-1065. Just to start off the this hour on a positive note, with some positive karma, $25 credit to play on FanDuel right now. Doesn't have to be golf. I mean, whatever you want it to be. Fantasy baseball, of course, daily fantasy baseball is available for you. It's tremendous. So right now, if you are caller 8 to 866-240-1065, you will get a $25 credit to FanDuel.com for whatever sport or type of contest that you want to play in. How's that sound? Very good. All right. Good stuff from Sam Miller of ESPN.com last hour. Really kind of talking about the role of the closer. I will say this, and Kushlin, you and I have talked about this before in the past, I think, too. You know, I don't have a ton of respect for the mindset or the mental strength or lack of mental strength, the mental fortitude, whatever you want to call it, of pitchers who think that I can get outs in one inning, but I can't get them in the other inning. You know, the ninth inning is a different mentality. It's a different mindset.
Yeah.
Therefore, you know, it's harder, so I've got to make more money than the guy who's getting him out in the eighth inning. And if I and or the other guy who says, you know, flip side, I can't get him out in the ninth inning, I can only get him out in the eighth inning. There's too much pressure to get the last out. I have never, ever understood that. To me, a free throw in the first quarter when the game is 16-15 is no more difficult, mentally or physically, than a free throw with 0.1 on the clock and the game tied. To me, you've got to make the stroke. You've got to make the right pitch. And I just feel like closers, or not closers, relief pitchers in general, but the ones that have this mindset, are just mentally weak. And I don't have a ton of respect for them. Now, and again, I'm not about everybody. I'm just saying in a general sense, those who feel like I can do it in one inning, but that inning is too hard, I've got a bit of a problem. And vice versa. I'm wired to get the outs that matter. I'm wired to pitch the ninth inning. If you ask me to come in the eighth inning,
yeah,
and there's room for error because somebody else can pitch the ninth, well, then I just don't know how to bear down and get those three. You know, I might, you know, if I'm forced to pitch out of my role. Jim, you talk about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about pitching closers in non-save situations.
I'm about to bring it up again, by the by.
Well, my mindset is, you know, I'm wired to do it this way. To me, you know what? If I can throw, you know, a fade route 45 yards on a rope right over the shoulder of my receiver and just over the outstretched fingers of the defensive back mm-hmm. in the first quarter, I can do it with the clock ticking down to 7, 6, 5 on a game in which I'm down by a field goal. If your mind isn't strong enough to let your body do what it has already proven it can do in one circumstance, if your mind won't let you tell your body to do it again in another circumstance, I just don't have a ton of respect. Make the free throw late, same way you would early. Make the throw late, same way you would early. Mm-hmm. If you're a pitcher, make the pitch you need to pitch in the eighth if you can make it in the ninth. And if you can make it in the eighth, if you can make it in the ninth, you can make it in the eighth, vice versa. Go ahead,
Jim. Yeah, and, you know, thinking about Sam Miller's article, we talked with him that last segment, and here's a fascinating microcosm. Right last night in that Indians game, on the one hand, you have the Indians and possibly with Andrew Miller, maybe the beginning stages of changing this. Now, we know it's clearly changed in the postseason from what we saw last October, but due to the main actual legitimate excuse – overworking, it'll take time, I think, to evolve the regular season, the 162 game slog and all that.
What do you mean? It would take time to do what? To get a guy's arm ready for more work than what he's used to doing to get it?
Not necessarily.
I'm not sure I followed.
What I mean by that is the one difference will be workload. You know, as Sam pointed out, as we pointed out, and we talked about this during the playoffs last year. Yeah, in middle of July, you're not going to see Andrew Miller in those situations for two innings. It'll be maybe one when the situation calls for it, and certainly not every day, just because you don't want to overwork them and have the old out of gas by the time you get to October.
Right.
But at the same time, I thought last night's game is a fascinating microcosm of kind of what we're talking about, at least from the Indians' perspective. Right? Down 5-1, as we know. They fought back. Free agent masher, Ed Encarnacion. By the way, side note, I love the dynamic. He didn't hit a single home run all spring until Friday's exhibition finale.
That's right.
And then he hits the key one last night. As if, yes, that's exactly why we signed you.
Yep.
So now it's tied. And what happened at the bottom of the eighth? They sent Andrew Miller out. And not just Andrew Miller in a tie game situation, but he faced 4, 5, and 6. First was former Indian Mike Napoli, struck him out on 5 pitches. Then Rougned Odor, who already had mashed a pair in this game.
Yep, off of Kluber, who did not look sharp, but who gutted it out,
yes,
by the way, to get through. He didn't allow a run from the third inning on, I think. He gutted it out through 4, 5, and 6.
Yeah.
And had some hard hit balls off him right at guys, but
absolutely,
he really did a great job.
At the end of the day,
in.
It's not that he was in a lot of like danger every inning, but a couple bad pitches that were mashed pretty far was the difference for him. But yeah, I completely agree on that. So Odor, 4 pitches, and instead of mashing another one, he grounds out Weekly to first, and then Jonathan Lucroy strikes out on 4 more pitches. So basically, an 11-pitch inning to get the middle of the order, 4, 5, and 6, and he sent them all down while the game was still tied. The reverse of this, I said I was going to bring the closer and non-save situation because I don't know what it is. I first started looking this up when the Indians still had Chris Perez. Remember Chris Perez
a
couple years back? And I don't know. it just always seemed
Isn't
to
that
me
the dude whose dog smoked
yeah,
weed.
right. But yeah, on the mound, anyway. But on the mound, he seemed to be the flashpoint of my argument. And I did some numbers. I forget which year it was, but one year I discovered in non-save situations his ERA was like two runs worse than in a closing situation. It's fascinating, but it keeps repeating itself. And who did the Indians beat up in the top of the ninth? Rangers closer Sam Dyson, who is in there in a non-save situation.
Yeah, boy, look at you. Look at you.
So I think we saw a little kind of microcosm of exactly what we're talking about, at least in a regular season mode, in that game. And the key...
And I have no respect. I mean, now I didn't hear. I don't really read a ton of the opposing cities' newspapers or listen to their broadcasts to see, but did Dyson use or did the manager use any of that for his performance? You know, came in the eighth or in a non-save situation or a tie game, wasn't right mentally, wasn't sharp, whatever the case might be. If they did, I have no respect. Now, if he didn't say that and, hey, no, I just blew the game or whatever, then I've got a lot more respect for that. But guys who will blame the
right
situation, save or non-save, eighth, right, ninth, whatever the case might be, those are the ones that I'm talking about that I'm really going to complain about.
And that's the key going forward if we're to see a re-evolution from closer to fireman or something like that. You're going to need more guys that have Andrew Miller's mindset. And by that I mean, ever since he was brought to Cleveland last summer in that trade, even his own mindset, and he more or less publicly said this, was, you know, I'll pitch wherever, you know, Tito tells me to pitch, you know, on and on and on. But a lot of guys, for more pay and finances than anything else, that's actually the sad part. That's why I love the title of Sam's article, The Tyranny of the Save, where once it might have been a good idea in theory to give, you know, relievers, you know, a little bit of credit, it's evolved to solely about contract status, less than actual game status. So you need a few more Andrew Millers, not necessarily in talent, but in that mindset of, it doesn't matter if I'm the closer.
Yeah, but you almost have to have that kind of talent to have that mindset that I'll do it wherever, because not everybody can do it if they don't. Again, the mental and physical talent that Miller possesses makes him uniquely qualified to do that.
And that is very, very true. But even for other guys who may not be as talented as Miller, they'd have to be willing to actually take that approach. The opposite of, say, if I'm not mistaken, Aroldis Chapman, who more or less said to the Yankees and the Cubs,
yep,
and now the Yankees again, nope, I am the ninth inning closer, end of story. That's more or less, that is the mindset in relievers that has to go, but it won't go if the financial incentives are there
for safe
as
codes
they are right now. That's what needs to be, you know, I think, fixed. That's what I've learned as I've thought more and more about this and read things like this over the course of this entire winter, and now we're starting the baseball season. It's less of manager usage, and it's about, they got to get that mindset out of relievers and front office guys where all the money is tied to. Because it's true. Dan Otero, for example, would never, ever, ever make anywhere near what an Andrew Miller or Cody Allen would because of how bullpens are structured.
Right. Very, very, very accurate. Very well said. All right, I want to shift gears a little bit onto the next item this afternoon right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. By the way, first of all, congratulations to James Robertson of Maumee. He won the $25 free FanDuel credit for any sport that you want. I'll tell you more about FanDuel and golf in just a few. But congratulations. I'm going to shift to the NFL / college football for just a second, if I may. Did you hear the comments made by Brian Kelly? Brian Kelly is, of course, the head coach at Notre Dame, and sometimes not the most popular coach in the world. For me, I quite frankly am not a fan. I'm not a fan of Brian Kelly's for a host of reasons. Some of it is personality. Some of it is results for the Fighting Irish. Some of it is personal with, I just can't get it out of my head that somebody died on his watch because he insisted on practicing in the wind, high, heavy, dangerous winds. And he insisted on his student photographer or cameraman who videotapes practice getting up on the big lift, you know, the scissor lift and videotaping practice. And, of course, it blew over.
Oh, yeah.
I know I shouldn't judge a guy by that. And obviously it was not intentional, but it was very misguided. And just it's a terrible try. Anyway, I'm not a big, huge fan of Brian Kelly in the first place. So I hope this doesn't color my opinion of this story. But Brian Kelly called into Sirius XM NFL radio yesterday, and he was asked about his former now Notre Dame quarterback, of course, Toledo's own Central Catholic star, Deshaun Kizer. and he made some statements that some are calling below the belt and unnecessary, and maybe a little bit inappropriate. When he talked about Deshaun Kizer, because he said the guy should have stayed in school because he's got a lot of growing up to do. I'll let you hear the 29-second clip for yourself. And then I want to talk about it and see what you have to say about it as well. This is Brian Kelly yesterday on NFL Radio.
Still should be in college. I mean, I think he needs more time to grow in so many areas, not just on the field, but off the field. You know, he's got a strong arm. Physically, he's gifted. I think he's got all the tools. He needs time. He's just not complete yet.
All right, that was only part of the 29-second clip, so, but that's okay, because the key part of that...
In so many areas, not just on the field, but off the field.
That's the line right there that I've got a bit of an issue with, and I think some other people do as well. One more time.
Still should be in college. I mean, I think he needs more time to grow in so many areas, not just on the field, but off the field.
Again, it's entirely possible that what he said was fair, and it's a fair objective analysis of his quarterback or his former quarterback, that maybe Deshaun Kizer would have been better served to have another year of preparation for the NFL game at the college level, coaching Notre Dame, playing in other big games, refining his skills, growing and developing, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe that's a fair and objective analysis. But what I heard was a little bit worse than that, because I heard a guy say that this guy isn't mature enough to play in the NFL right now. And while Brian Kelly may have been speaking about Deshaun Kizer in suggesting that, in his own opinion, Kaiser's best interest would be served by another year of football in college, by saying that he has too much growing to do, not just on the field, but off it, you're not serving his best interest as he makes the decision. Kelly went on to say that he does support his decision. If this is what he wanted to do, he wishes him all the best and hopes he is successful, but he's not helping him be successful. I think if you state for the record on national radio that, in your opinion, this quarterback has growing up to do off the field, you may scare away a coach or a general manager that was considering taking him in the first round. And you may push him down 10 picks, 12 picks into the second round. And as you know, slipping in the NFL draft from the first round to the second round isn't a matter of ego or prestige. Millions of dollars are attached to it in your rookie contract. Why would Brian Kelly feel the need to say this guy is immature? And I'm paraphrasing that, but when he says he's got growing up to do off the field, it says that he's not mature.
Still should be in college. I mean, I think he needs more time to grow in so many areas, not just on the field, but off the field. You know, he's got a strong arm. Physically, he's gifted. I think he's got all the tools. He needs time. He's just not complete yet.
Physically, he's gifted. He's got a great arm. He's got all the tools, but he's not complete yet. I'm trying to figure out the motivation there. If your goal is to help your player become a successful NFL player, and I would hope that's what every college coach wants for their players, if they're potential NFL prospects, be drafted as high as you can, make as much money as you can, be successful, because A, it's what I want for you after you put in your efforts and sacrifices here for me and my program in college, in this case at Notre Dame, but B, it also is self-serving. Every successful Notre Dame player that goes into the NFL is a recruiting tool. I can pitch guys, say, you want to come and play quarterback for me. Look at what Kizer did. Played for me. Look at him now. Top draft pick, top 15 of the draft, whatever the case might be. Started in his second year in the NFL. We'll get you ready for the pros. Come play for us. You would think that that's the motivation here. But yet Brian Kelly's statement essentially said, he's not ready. He's got the tools, but he's not ready. And he's not ready not only on the field, he's also not ready off the field. So, yeah, good luck with that, NFL coaches and GMs who are thinking about taking him. How does that help him? How does that help himself? Doesn't help Deshaun Kizer. Doesn't help Brian Kelly. Doesn't help Notre Dame. Why is he saying this? Look, this is the 29-second clip here. I want to see if it adds any of the context that I was looking for.
Still should be in college. I mean, I think he's you know, but the circumstances are such that you have to make business decisions. And, you know, he felt like it was in his best interest, and I'm going to support him and his decision. And
there it is. That's part of it, that one I was missing. He felt it was in his best interest, and I'm going to support him in his decision. How is telling GMs, I don't think he's ready for your game, supporting him? You know, I mean, in my estimation, if I'm Notre Dame, if I'm a Notre Dame fan, I'm a little bit upset by this. This is how you show quote-unquote support for your underclassman, non-graduate quarterback. In this case, happens to be from Toledo's Central Catholic. This is how you support him, by saying to the NFL, he's not ready. He's got tools, but he's not ready. He needed another year of college to grow up, both on the field and off the field, so that means he's immature. If that's supporting him, if I'm a Notre Dame fan, I'm upset, because you're hurting recruiting in the exact opposite way that I just described you'd be helping recruiting. If you help get DeShone Kizer drafted higher, and you tell the scouts, the GMs, or anybody who asks you, like a radio host, in this case it's on radio, yeah, I think his physical tools, you know, and I'm not saying lie. You don't say he's the most mature NFL-ready guy I've ever had. I'm not saying lie. It's kind of like when if you're a boss and you have somebody who leaves your company either by your, well, usually it's by their choice, or else they wouldn't be asking for a reference. But if you have somebody who leaves by their choice and they're going to work for another company, and your employee, former employee, says, may I use you as a reference? And the boss says, sure. Sometimes if they don't necessarily think the highest of you, it's not incumbent upon them to lie and say, yeah, he's the best employee we ever had. I'm sad that he left. It stinks. This is terrible. We wish he was still with us. I'm not saying you have to do that. But what you do is you just say the positive things and you swallow the negative things. You just say, yeah, he was a really hard worker. Really came in every day prepared to get after it. You might say the talent wasn't there. The productivity wasn't where we would like it to be, but he worked his tail off. You just say the positive things and you swallow the negative things. That makes you not a liar, right? Why can't Brian Kelly, when asked for a job reference here for DeShone Kizer, just say, tremendous tools, great arm, physical size in the pocket is going to be a huge asset at the NFL level. And stop there. Why add the, yeah, he should have stayed with me another year? Unless it's bitterness, unless it's anger because he's going to have to find and get another quarterback ready that he wasn't expecting he'd have to do. But whatever it is, he could have helped recruiting for the Fighting Irish had he put a positive spin on this and pushed DeShone Kizer to the pros, meaning pushed him, his name and his ability to the scouts who might be listening to ask head coach for their opinion, you know, his college coach. Get him drafted higher. It's a great recruiting point for you. Get him drafted lower. It hurts you. Say negative things about him publicly. It hurts you and your ability to recruit. The rest of that clip.
But the reality of it is he needs more football. He needs more time to grow, and he'll learn with great coaches around him, a great mentor around him. So there's a huge amount of growth that will happen every single day with DeShone Kizer.
So there's, you know, there's some positive, and then there's some negative, and I guess I just don't understand the reason for the negative. And maybe if there are any Central Catholic fans or alums or family or whatever have some thoughts on DeShone. I'm just kind of curious how you feel about his now former college coach, Brian Kelly, kind of taking him down a peg or two in this national or satellite radio interview. Kush, Frank?
You know, it is something that felt unnecessary, you know, listening to it again, because you're right, you know, why have to throw that out there, you know, that'll get guys like us talking about it, because you're right. I heard it the same way as you did, which is more or less there's a maturity level for the NFL game that he doesn't have yet. And it makes me wonder why he would say that. I mean, as far as I know,
that
crack there's
about
been...
having a lot of growing to do, not just on the field but off, to me was, I don't know, it
that
was
to me
excessive.
Was the key line. For me, that was the key line in the whole thing, because it's going to bring unnecessary questions now, you know, to both sides. Because as far as I know, I haven't really read or seen anything that indicate that there's issues between the two, or that there had been his entire time at Notre Dame.
That's what makes me wonder if this isn't just a little bit of bitterness because Kelly really wanted him back for another year. You know,
in which case, that speaks not very well of Brian Kelly.
here's a guy in Kaiser who started 23 games at the college level for Notre Dame against top quality competition. Now, his record is not impressive, 12-11.
Right.
But that's not all on the quarterback. Mm-hmm. That is a lot on the rest of the club, the rest of the you know the program that Brian Kelly recruits and making sure that they're you know a well-rounded club. But during his 23 starts, he's thrown for 5,809 yards, 47 touchdowns against 19 interceptions. He's also run for 992 yards and 18 more touchdowns. Not bad numbers. Brian Kelly's probably looking at that and saying, you know, there were some mistakes in there. There weren't enough wins in there, but man, did he get better and more experienced because of all of that. Wait until you see what we can do with him at the helm in 2017. Wait, what? You're going to the NFL? Dude, you're not ready for that yet. Come back here and play one more year. Maybe it's more self-serving than anything else. And once Kaiser said, no, I'm told that I'm going to be one of the top three quarterbacks taken, and if that's what they're telling me, that's too much money to leave on the table. What if I come back and play one more year for you, blow out a knee, blow out a shoulder, suffer a massive concussion, Lord knows what. There's money on the table for me here. I'm going to go get what I can get right now and hopefully develop there. And instead of Brian Kelly saying, you know what, kid, you're right. Let's go do this. I'll do whatever I can for you. And actually, maybe he did say that. In the article, not on the audio that I played, in the article, about this story, Kelly also said that, quote, once a decision was made, we were united, and we went to work to put him in the best situation. I assume that means draft-wise. But then here you are just, you know, a few short weeks before the draft. What day does the draft, Jim, start?
27th, I want to say.
So just, what, 3 weeks away, roughly. You're on an NFL satellite radio show saying that, yeah, he's not mature enough, or he needs, quote, or he needs, what was it, time to grow, or he has more growing to do. Here, one more time.
He should be in college. I mean, I think he needs more time to grow in so many areas, not just on the field, but off the field.
Yeah, that's the one. He needs time to grow in so many areas, not just on the field, but off the field. That's not putting him in the best situation. It's just not. And I don't understand the reason for it. I don't think it's necessary to take shots at the kid like that, especially if you really are trying to help him, maximize his ability to be taken higher and possibly maybe even the first quarterback taken in the draft. Who knows? You don't know. One GM's trash is another man's treasure. You know, one guy might look at Deshaun Watson of Clemson and say, that's Michael Jordan, the way Dabo Swinney calls him. And another one might say, no, that's Vince Young. That's not going to work. Another one might see Deshaun Kaiser and say, you know what, that guy's got all of the tools, big, tall, strong, stand-in-the-pocket guy, but also has great feet, too. And somebody else might say, yeah, dude's 12-11 at Notre Dame, can't win, don't want him. Somebody might say Mitch Trubisky, the best tools of everybody in the draft, that's the guy that's going to be the franchise quarterback for the next 12 years for somebody. Next guy, GM, is going to say, yeah, but he started, what, 12 games at North Carolina? How come he couldn't beat out the other guy last year? How come he couldn't beat out the guy before that the year before? So that's just the way that it is. Different coaches are going to see different things. Different GMs are going to see different things. And it should be Brian Kelly's job, or at least his goal, to help them see the positive things about Deshaun Kaiser, not the negative. Eric is in Toledo. He's got some thoughts on this. Eric, you're on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Hey, guys. Listen to the show all the time. I've called in a couple of times, mm-hmm. So you kind of know me a little bit. Going to Central Catholic, I've had two opportunities to actually, like, talk to Deshaun Kaiser. He is a very well-read young man. He speaks clearly. He talks with, like, you can just tell the confidence beams from him. If he feels that he is ready to take the next step in his career, then I feel like he needs to do that. If he thinks he's ready for the NFL, then that's where he should go. He's not one of those guys, I felt, that would, you know, overestimate his ability. He's always stayed very humble, and he's just given everything he can to whatever program. As a sophomore, starting for Central, first game of the season, they had an opportunity to win it. He threw an interception. They went on to have a great season that year. His junior year, he takes them to state, throws two interceptions all season long. I mean, and then his senior year, they fell in the district final, but he's matured each way. He's brought Toledo back on the map. And if he stays humble, why shouldn't he be able to go to the NFL, take care of his business, and work on things with guys that will always be there in his corner? I don't feel like Brian Kelly's in his corner.
I don't either. And that's kind of the point of all this. I could not have said better everything that you just said. Now, I couldn't have said it at all because I don't know him. You've talked to him a couple times, like you said, and that's great. And by the way, as far as how he presents vocally or verbally, I have no doubt because he's extraordinarily intelligent. You don't get into Notre Dame, and I don't care if you're 6'4 and 250 and run a 4.25, you don't get into Notre Dame unless you're incredibly intelligent. That's just the way that it is for their athletes. It's why sometimes they have a hard time recruiting when other schools don't, because they'll let guys in who don't have the best grades. So DeShone Kizer's clearly very intelligent, clearly very, I think you said, confidence brims from him when he speaks, and I completely understand and agree with all of that, which leads to the inevitable conclusion here. If you don't say positive things about him, like you just did, then you're not in his corner. And it's pretty clear that his former head coach now at Notre Dame is not necessarily thrilled with his decision to leave, and maybe he's taking that out on him right now.
I think he's upset.
Yeah.
I mean, he looks at what DeShone Kizer did. You got to remember, when DeShone Kizer went in, he was coming in behind Malik Zaire. Everyone was talking about Zaire. Malik Zaire is going to be this. He's going to be the next star after Everett Golson. Well, Malik Zaire didn't pan out. And who steps into that role like no tomorrow and has, in my opinion, a great career? It may not have been the national championship, big game, bowl games. But you know what? He stepped in and he performed week in and week out.
I wouldn't call it, in my opinion, Eric, a great career, only because 12-11 isn't great. It's mediocre as a record. And the yards that I talked about, the 5,800 yards, the 47 touchdowns and 19 interceptions, those are really, really good but not great. I think if he had come back for one more year and continued that growth and put up more stats and more wins, he could have elevated to what you could call a great college career. But I don't blame him at all for saying, you know what, I don't think that's helping me. I feel like I'm ready. And if I feel like I'm ready and NFL GMs are telling me I'm ready and agents are telling me where I'm going to be drafted and I know I've got that guaranteed life-changing money in front of me, I'm going to make this decision, and I absolutely support his reason for doing it. Eric, great call, my friend. Let me get to a couple of other people on the air now. Jim and Maumee, you're next on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Bob,
hi, Jim. Go right ahead.
I just want to tell you a great show as always.
Thank you, Jim.
I just got a little food for thought in the Kizer situation. I thought, you know, in the past they've said some of the great quarterbacks weren't ready for the NFL, but I think possibly one of the biggest reasons he chose to go because there was the looming that Kelly might lose his job and he'd have to start a whole new coaching staff and start all over, and maybe he just didn't want to deal with that. That's all I got to say, Bob. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Let me consider that for just a moment. It's possible, first of all. I would say improbable, however, because generally speaking, if coaching changes were going to be made at Notre Dame, they would have been made before DeShone Kizer declared for the NFL draft. I mean, you know, if you just kind of look at all of the big jobs that came open and that were filled, they were done almost right after the end of the college season because everybody knows you've got to get a jump on recruiting immediately. And plus, you've got to get the new coach, if you're going to change coaches, has to get ready for spring practice immediately. I don't think that DeShone Kizer would have made that decision thinking Kelly was going. If Kelly was going to be gone, I think he would have been gone. However, having said that, you're right. If a change had been made, you know, every coach comes in with his own idea about what he's looking for and the kind of player he wants at that key position. And maybe DeShone Kizer would have been his experienced favorite guy. And maybe he wouldn't have been. Maybe he would have said, you know what, 12-11, I can do better with this young freshman or this young sophomore coming up behind Kizer, who's the wave of the future. So you could be right. I think it's improbable only because I think if Kelly would have been gone, he'd have known it by now. I just think DeShone Kizer took his time and made an educated decision about what's best for his future. And I can't dispute it. And I'll tell you something else, too. And I know I'm getting really off into the weeds here because this is all speculative. But I'll tell you this. If Kelly's comments publicly on NFL radio, on satellite, were this disparaging of him, maybe there wasn't a very good relationship with him privately either. You know, maybe the decision was made because he wanted to get away from Brian Kelly. Because maybe what Kelly said publicly is a small little tiny, you know, example of what he says to him privately. Maybe he rides him hard. Maybe he calls him immature. Maybe he does this, that, or the other thing. Maybe he holds him to blame for the 12-11 record and 23 starts. And maybe that's one of the things that drove Kizer away. But either way, I support the kid. Steve in Toledo, you're on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
How you guys doing today?
Good, man. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been following the draft since I was probably 12 years old. I'm 30 now, and I was trying to think back of a time when a college coach kind of talked negatively about their quarterback going pro. And the only one that came close to me was Pete Carroll when Mark Sanchez came out. And the difference between, I believe, even that to what Brian Kelly did here was...
Well, hold on. Refresh our memory. What did Carroll say, even if you paraphrase it?
If you remember when Sanchez had come out, he had only started 1 year.
Okay. Yeah, I remember that.
12 or 13 games. He had a really good season. I believe it was right after Matt Leinart? Regardless, you know, Carroll had come out and said, look, I think he has everything. He has all the tools, but I know NFL GMs want you to have more starts. And that's kind of where he said, and I think he should come back. And, you know, they had made a whole thing that Sanchez was just a different guy and that he was going to do his own
thing. So how do you compare what Kelly said about Kizer to that one? Are you saying, which one are you saying is worse?
Well, what I'm saying is I can look at Pete. I was trying to defend Brian Kelly, but then when I was listening to the auto replay, Carroll actually sounded concerned, you know, and I felt like he had the best interest. When I listened to Brian Kelly, it's just like, woe is me. Like, this wasn't about Kizer and him, and it was more of, I just want to kick a guy to kick a guy.
Yeah.
The concern. I didn't feel like he cared. And frankly, you know,
let me cut it there, my friend. Steve, let me cut it there only because I'm way late anyway, but I appreciate your call and I get your point. I think it also was to kick a guy. I think it was all much more self-serving. I think Brian Kelly's complaining that DeShone Kizer is leaving is because he's mad that he's not staying with him. And so, therefore, you know what? He shouldn't be going. He's not mature. He's got more growing to do on the field and off the field. And that's a problem. That, to me, is Brian Kelly not having his best, the player's best interest in mind. And you know what? Again, I said at the top of this conversation, I didn't want to let my lack of support for or the fact that I didn't like Brian Kelly to color my opinion of this situation, but perhaps it does, because I hope, even though I support Notre Dame football, I hope that recruits take a long, close look at Brian Kelly and his treatment of DeShone Kizer in this case before they decide to go to South Bend. You know, and I'm not saying don't go, but I just look very closely and see if this guy looks out for his players the best that he can based on his treatment of DeShone Kizer's decision to go to the NFL. I'll just leave it there. All right. Hey, I told you I would get you back to this. I'm going to get back there now. FanDuel and Fantasy Golf. The Masters starts in 2 days. If you love golf and winning money, then you've got to do Fantasy Golf at FanDuel. And this Thursday, the Masters tees off. Get your golfer lineup picked. Pick 8 golfers for your team. And then you got a salary cap you have to use, so you can pick some really top-of-the-line players and then some lower ones on the salary scale. But then you track them, watch your score live, and as they score eagles and birdies and pars, et cetera, you score points, and you win cash prizes. There's something for everybody. Contests start at just $1. And also Thursday, the $750,000 Golden Eagle Golf Tournament begins with $100,000 going to first place. It costs you $4 to enter. Think about that for a moment. So get your lineup in. And by the way, if you're a baseball fan, and who isn't, daily fantasy baseball at FanDuel is back as well. It's a tremendous amount of fun. That's how over 2.5 million players have won cash prizes playing fantasy sports at FanDuel. So here's what you do to get started. New users get FanDuel's combo 5-pack valued at up to $50, and you get it free. That's right, five free entries to a combination of 50-50 beginner contests. Just finish in the top half to win cash. To get your five freebies, go to FanDuel.com, click on the Join Now button, and enter the promo code FRANCE, F-R-A-N-T-Z, France. That's FanDuel.com, promo code France, void where prohibited. Right back with the final.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yeah, wrapping it up, just a couple of minutes left of the extravaganza. Really appreciate all the great thoughts on DeShone Kizer, especially the gentleman who called who said he's talked to him a couple of times at Central Catholic as an alum. And you know, to me, you got to know somebody. The rest is all speculative. I'm speculating. Everybody else is speculating if you don't know the kid. That's why really he was asking anybody who knows him, anybody who went to school with him, any family members, whatever. Because he's a Toledo product, it just kind of helps the conversation. And I agree with everything the caller said. DeShone Kizer is highly intelligent. He is a man of integrity, a young man of integrity. It's weird to call a young college student a man, but he is a man. He's a grown man now, and he has integrity, and he made the right decision for him. And I think Brian Kelly really owes him and probably all of the other Notre Dame players an apology for that. Guys, Frank Gargano, you especially didn't weigh in on this. Thoughts on Mr. Kizer and what Coach Brian Kelly had to say about him?
Yeah, I've got a kind of out-of-the-bounds theory. I mean, I think we've all been a little bit speculative of what's going on, but isn't this the perfect way to deflect what happened last year for Brian Kelly? Yeah, we went 4-8, but we had a quarterback. He's talented, don't get me wrong, but he kind of wasn't fully developed as much as these other quarterbacks we had to play, so that's why we had kind of a rough time.
That's interesting, although it would be counter to the message of he needs another year in college, because that's saying I want him back. And if he's trying to kind of pass the buck on to Kizer saying my quarterback play wasn't good enough, it's why we were 4-8, don't hold me accountable for that, then you wouldn't want him back. You'd help him out the door. You know what I'm saying? You'd say, you know, all right, yeah, I fully support his decision to go pro. He's got a lot of great tools. Man, I can't wait to get started with my new QBs. And I didn't hear much of that. I do think that Kelly was being selfish. I just think it's in a different way than what you just described. I think he wanted him back. I think he knows that a guy who's thrown for 5,800 yards in his college career so far and 47 touchdowns against 19 interceptions can do a lot of great things for you and that you can win a lot of football games with him. I think he knows that. And the fact that Kizer is going to bail on him after, by the way, what was the storyline going into this past season? Is DeShone Kizer going to be the quarterback, or does Zaire get his job back?
Right.
Malik Zaire.
Yeah.
That was the story. It was a quarterback controversy, if you will, a battle.
I remember that, yeah.
And Kelly picked Kizer, and Zaire's gone from Notre Dame now. So you know, maybe Kelly feels like he owes me another year. I chose him, and this is the way he repays me. He's bailing. First time somebody says there might be money at the end of his rainbow. You know, so that might be why, one of the reasons why he took a couple of shots there and said, I think he's got more growing to do on the field.
And no matter how you speculate or try to look at it, it doesn't seem like it's a good look for Kelly. And that's my main takeaway from this.
Not at all. And if it's not a good look for Kelly, then it's not a good look for Notre Dame. And
precisely.
If it's not a good look for Notre Dame, it's not a good look to recruits. And that's something that could have far reaching implications, much, much more so than DeShone Kizer's situation himself. All right. That is all the time we've got. Thanks for a great conversation. Thanks again to Sam Miller from ESPN.com and ESPN the Magazine talking relief pitching with us. And thanks to you. A lot of items we didn't get to today. We'll try to catch up on tomorrow. By the way, congrats to the Tigers who won their season opener after being rained out yesterday. They did take care of business today.
But it's not over yet. It's 6-2 in the eighth.
Well, I'm calling it over because Justin Verlander's day is over. And yeah. Anthony Fenech tweeted a couple of seconds ago. he said Verlander's day is done. He's the first Tigers opening day starter to strike out double-digit batters since Mickey Lolich in 70.
That's crazy.
Which is crazy. And he said he was booed by the Chicago crowd as he walked off the field. He smirked at them.
You mean all 300 of them?
Yes. And by the way, why would he not smirk at them? He just struck out 10, and he's on his way to walk into the arms of a relatively decent-looking girlfriend. Slash Fiona. Are they engaged, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. They're not married yet,
I don't think.
I didn't miss the wedding, did I?
No, we didn't.
I'm waiting for my invitation to that.
Yeah, I'll be checking the mail for
anyway,
that one.
Anyway, I'm calling that one. It's 6-2 in the eighth. I'm calling that one. They're going to win their first game of the season, and so that's where we'll leave it. Tomorrow, The NHL says that no, they will not allow their players in season to go participate in the Olympics. One NHL superstar says, screw you, I'm going to play no matter what you say. That story and much, much more, including more on Tony Romo's latest on tomorrow's program. Stay where you are, because for now, Drive Time is coming.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.